We've got a fantastic panel here to talk about RHI and the media. You've probably seen them across BBC, UTV and RTE. Beside me to my right, I have the security correspondent for the Irish News, Alison Morris. And sitting to my left, we have Sam McBride, who's the political editor of the newsletter. And both of these two journalists were really to the fore in the RHI story. They were probably the most profiled journalists of all the commentators and journalists in the Northern Ireland Press Corps. So what we're going to do first is I'm going to ask Alison and Sam just to give their initial impressions, because the RHI debacle was something that was 4 years in the making, from the scheme's introduction to the eventual collapse of the government in January of this year. So I'm going to get the guys to give a wee bit of an overview of their impressions of it and some of the lessons from that. So I'll start with Alison, if you want to kick off.
Yeah, well, I think when you look at RHI and you look at the sort of progression of it as a news story and basically as a political crisis, it can't be taken in isolation, because it wasn't an event that happened on its own. What we had before that was the Red Sky scandal, which again, you know, was hinted full of corruption and the misappropriation of public funds. And then we had NAMA, which I think came straight after that. And I think what happened with RHI, which I suppose really caught the public's imagination, because for a long time we were writing stories about this, and the politicians were basically trying to make it go away, and they thought, much like NAMA, much like everything else, we'll just ride the crest this wave, we'll ride it out, it'll all disappear, it'll all go away. I think with RHI, what happened was differently, was the public really got RHI. You know, NAMA were talking about property and high finance and, you know, global property companies buying this and that. Most people sort of switched off halfway through it. But RHI was a very simple scandal to understand. You give them £1, they give you £1.60 back. Do you know what I mean? That was basically it. And we all, you know, have struggled to pay our bills and our heating bills and our food bills. You know, my children, every time they try to turn the heating on, I used to scream at them to put another jumper on. And then we hear that there's some farmer with an empty shed running 8 boilers and at 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, while pensioners are sitting wearing 2 cardigans, you know. And I think that really captured the public's imagination, and it was just the full scale of that amount of complete and utter waste of public money. And when that happens, and when the public catch on, and I think that was because the press, we kept hammering these stories and people were saying, like, that's boring now, you know, you can't keep putting the same story on the front page. But the Irish News did keep putting it on the front page, and eventually then people do have to be held to account, because while politicians in Northern Ireland at times may feel like they are totally unaccountable and they will ride out most scandals, they couldn't ride out this. The DUP just couldn't ride it out. The public was just, I mean, the anger, it was the only thing people were talking about. When you get a political scandal in Northern Ireland, it's usually quite boring and politics is quite dry. And this wasn't. This was, you know, people were stopping me in Tesco. You know, people were talking about it in the shops. People were talking about it in taxi queues. And it wasn't going to go away. And I think that was the difference. I think that the public really got behind this and they said, no, enough. You know, we've had all these allegations of corruption. We've had all these investigations. They've came to nothing. Nobody's ever held accountable. Nobody ever loses their job. This time it's going to be different. And I think that was what the difference was with RHI. From a journalistic point of view, it was a very interesting time to be a journalist. I think the last 3 years have been a very interesting time to be a journalist. We used to always say there's quiet times and high times. So the summer was always busy, quiet to Christmas. This happened at Christmas. There was no quiet time. We were all working on this right up until Christmas Eve. But it's a very fulfilling thing, because if you went back 5 or 6 years ago, we had people telling us that newspaper journalism was dead. You know, it's dead tree journalism, it's over. The internet's the way it went. And I think that newspaper journalists, in this case, really led the way. They really did the investigative work. The like of the BBC and the main broadcasters were probably found wanting in a lot of cases and found chasing behind after the newspapers. And I think that people like Sam, is, you know, did marvellous work in refusing to let this go. And from an Irish News point of view, it was probably a very easy story to cover. I think from Sam's point of view, it was probably harder. I mean, he's working for a unionist newspaper and holding a unionist party to account, and I think for him it probably brought a whole load of other sort of challenges that came along with that. So I think, you know, his role in it shouldn't be underestimated.
Okay, thanks very much, Alison. Sam, your impressions of the RHI scandal?
Yes, I suppose this event to a certain extent is implicitly praising the media in terms of how we've uncovered some of the aspects of this over the last 6 months, 7 months or so, and I think that the media has done a pretty good job here. We get lots of things wrong. I think we've done a pretty good job on this. But I think it also has to be said that there's a bit of a need for a mea culpa from the media as well, because along with the entire political class, nobody caught this until it was really too late to do anything significant about it. Nobody caught this when the regulations were going through the Assembly. Nobody caught this at the committee stage. Nobody caught this as the payments were going up. Successive ministers, the opposition, the DUP's partners in government. I think there are a lot of people who share the blame for that. That's not to in any way suggest that the DUP don't take the bulk of the blame, the civil service don't take the bulk of the blame, because they were the people who were responsible for drafting the regulations. If something sinister happened there, it was their responsibility either not to do that themselves or to spot it if someone around them was engaged in that sort of activity. I think one of the things which this has exposed, I suppose, is the lack of expertise in the Assembly chamber. There is a lot of deadwood in terms of backbench MLAs, people who are loyal party servants, people who troop through the lobby, vote the way they are expected to vote, the way the leadership tells them to vote. That is good for political parties sometimes. It makes managing those Assembly groups easier. And it's not just an issue for the DUP or even just for Sinn Féin. SDLP, Ulster Unionists have significant issues there as well. When it comes to actually scrutinising what can be very dry regulations about renewable heat. I mean, who on earth would think that would be something that would be particularly interesting or difficult or dangerous or whatever? There's a lack of that. There are a handful of MLAs, the likes of Jim Allister from a legal background, who do get stuck into some of this stuff at points, but there's a real deficit, I think, there in terms of that. I've been off for a few weeks actually, and I'm just was trying to refresh my memory before I came here as to some of the sequence of this. And going back to, I mean, just in terms of the fact that I completely missed this when the regulations were going through the Assembly, it was not a high-profile political issue. When you go back and look at Hansard, it was not debated in any significant way by MLAs or by anybody else. The first time that it really came to my attention was February 2015, when Jonathan Bell moved to close the scheme completely. And the aspect of that which really drew my eyes to it was that the press release came out on a Friday evening, 6:02 p.m. Generally, you would struggle to find a civil servant past certainly about 4:30, 5 o'clock if you're trying to get a press query answered. So for them to be issuing a press release of such import at that point always draws your attention to it. I think maybe 10, 15 years ago in the Alistair Campbell era, that was seen as a good slot to bury bad news. I think things have moved on a long way from there, and actually it's something which draws attention to an issue if you put it out at that point. And I think I put in an FOI request at that point, which was knocked back, as to just what it exactly had gone on in terms of the timing of that, but I still wasn't really terribly alert to what was going on. And really, I think, fast-forwarding a very long way, there was an audit office report, there were different things, but really I think to slightly disagree with respect with one thing that Alison said there, I think the BBC does deserve a lot of credit in this, particularly its spotlight unit, because really that was what drew my attention to it, and that was what drew the attention of the wider public to it, and that was something which demonstrated the power of television. The image of Conor Spackman burning, literally burning notes, which apparently were fake notes, but they were very convincing on that camera. I mean, it really made me angry. We know that hospital waiting lists are out of control. We've all got friends and family members who are struggling to get seen for very serious conditions. The idea that people were literally burning through money with gay abandon, nobody cared about this, and potentially there was something sinister to it, there was something corrupt to it. I mean, it really made me angry as a citizen, and I think that sometimes it can be dangerous for a journalist to be too involved emotionally or whatever in a story. It's bad if a journalist is simply reinforcing their own bias through what they're doing, but I think sometimes it's good to have a bit of righteous anger about something which is transparently wrong and is completely indefensible. So really, I think that was the point at which I became interested, and from then on it sort of took on a life of its own.
Okay, right. I'm going to ask a few questions first, and then I'm going to throw it open to you guys to ask Sam and Alison. We were talking a wee bit about, I mean, Sam, you said that obviously implicit in this event is that maybe the media did something really, really well here. But from your point of view, what did the media get? You hinted on some of this, but if you go into it in a wee bit more depth, what did the media get wrong in this whole snap? Because, I mean, we were at the DUP conference last November. This had already been in the Irish news. And yet the story from the conference was Arlene, it's on fire, nothing about RHI. Go ahead.
How apt that seems now. I think credit to John Manley, my counterpart at the Irish News, who did ask Arlene Foster about this. I mean, I think in defence of those of us who didn't, there were so many issues. This was Brexit, this was the first opposition at Stormont, there were all sorts of issues going on. Clearly this was a massive issue, but it's sort of an annual chance for a big sit-down interview with the leader. There are a multitude of things, really, which you could ask. But, I mean, John, with hindsight, clearly was completely right to go down that route. I think that initially, and he'll be very glad to hear me say that. Initially, I think, clearly we got it wrong. I think there is an aspect here of a shrunken media in Belfast. When I started at the newsletter almost 10 years ago, I think our staff was about double what it is now. The Irish News probably isn't quite as bad as that in terms of cuts. Belfast Telegraph probably is as bad as that. That's where I was beforehand. And I think that there are implications of that. Yes, we can do more with less. Technology lets us dispense with some roles. We are able to get round things. We can get round various corners and soften various edges. But fundamentally, going through legislation, difficult legislation, dry legislation, takes time. It takes expertise. It takes somebody who's been there for a while, who knows the sort of bear traps to look out for. That's not to say that any of us would have spotted it if we'd necessarily done that. But I think the story of this really is that this is one scandal which we now know about. There are unquestionably scores of scandals similar to this, maybe not in terms of their size, in terms of their financial implications, but in terms of their importance to individual people in particular, parts of Northern Ireland, particular communities, which are just being missed because there are a handful of us. I'm the only political reporter at the newsletter. There's one political reporter at the Irish News. There's, I think, one at the Belfast Telegraph. BBC have a few more, got bigger resources. But even 15 years ago, the Belfast Telegraph would have had, I think, four political correspondents, and that was before you had devolved government, before there was actually really serious decisions being taken by local politicians, and really a lot of it was direct rule, just rubber stamping rather than anything else. So I think that's certainly the problem then. And I think coming forward in terms of how we have covered this over the last 6 months, I think one criticism of how some of the media coverage of this, and I mean, I have to feed into this, I suppose, is that some of it has simplified this too much to simply be a story that the DUP screwed up or the DUP were corrupt. It may be that people in the DUP were corrupt, and the inquiry will hopefully give us a lot more detail on that. There's no evidence of that at this point, and I certainly have seen no evidence of that at this point. There are implications as to why people did certain things, but people can have all sorts of motivations and all sorts of pressures on them as to why they would do something. But actually, potentially the bigger story here is not just that nobody spotted it, but that the civil service, which is supposed to provide expertise to ministers are not experts in renewable heat or any of these sorts of areas, they really dropped the ball in this spectacularly, and really since then have continued to drop the ball, and the department, which I think Arlene Foster then has to take a very significant degree of responsibility for, because she is the democratic accountability for what goes on there, really is pretty dysfunctional. And it's very clear now with hindsight, and at the time I think too many of us probably failed to spot that and had the sense that she had a fairly easy department, that she was going to photo ops, she was opening new businesses, whatever. She wasn't really responsible for that much. Actually, beneath the surface, we now know that an awful lot was going on that we didn't spot.
Okay. Alison, media. Where do you think the media fell down during this?
Well, the audit report did show that this was unfeasible, and that this was financially an unfeasible scheme, and that there had been no checks put in place to stop people exploiting it. And that, I think, should have at the time been made into a massive story. Instead, it did take a couple of months in the sort of simmering. I know what Sam said about, you know, you shouldn't get too emotionally invested in the story. I find that very difficult because I'm just one of those kind of people. But John Manley, who is the political correspondent, he wouldn't be that fond of farmers. Like, let's just say that. So so he did take it very personally. So when he was given a chance to interview...
Understatement of the century.
When he was given a chance to interview Arlene Foster in October, which is an interview that the leaders of the parties would do, you know, once or possibly twice a year, he did ask her about this, and he asked her, you know, what she was doing about it while she was the minister at the time, and she said, "You can't expect me to be across every jot and tittle." And I think that came back to haunt her, you know, that phrase, because it was clear that she had not been across any of it. When she was questioned on it, obviously the blame went straight to the civil servants. And I think that was, from a leadership point of view, that was incredibly wrong. It was handled very badly. And we know we're talking about, you know, spin doctors and political spin doctors of the past. I think a decent spin doctor would never have allowed that to happen, because her leadership immediately at that point in time, I think, was called into question, even from, you know, unionist voters, because they were thinking, you know, you were the person, the buck stopped with you, why are you blaming on the civil servants? You should have checked it. They are experts, they are there to hire them, but you're the minister, so the buck stops with you. If I mess up, I mess up, but my editor has to take responsibility for my mess, and that's just the way the world works. She was the manager of that department, she was the minister, and she should have been across it. I think, too, from a media perspective, we do try to oversimplify stories, and that is just because not everybody, I suppose most of the people in this room probably are political anoraks, but not everybody is. And so when we're writing a story, you have to always make sure that you're explaining it as much as you can to every single person who's going to read, and that sometimes means that you do oversimplify it, and you do cut out of a lot of the jargon and a lot of the political jargon. I think from that point of view, we could have been on it sooner. That was completely obvious. I think that we could have pressed it harder sooner. I think that all the media at this point in time weren't singing off the same hymn sheet. You know, some, such as John and his dislike for farmers, was pushing this chicken farmer sort of idea that this money was specifically benefiting them. Others, that's not a very sexy story, really, when you think about it, as the chicken farmers are getting more money. So it had to be brought down and simplified to the point where people realised that not only were they getting paid over the amount they were paying for it, that some people were actually just running their haters constantly and abusing the system. And I think it was the abuse of the system that caught the public's imagination. But you don't expect a green energy scheme to be controversial. I mean, who does? This turned out to be the least environmental green energy scheme of all time. You know, it's just stuff getting pumped into the environment that had no need to be there. So I think you can see why, because we were in the middle of sort of ongoing political crisis at this time. We were lurching from one big story to another. You can see how it went unnoticed. But I think that in the future, if there's one thing that will be learned from it, is those very boring and very dry audit reports that can be, you know, this size. I think most of us will take a longer period of time to scrutinise them.
And before I throw it open to the floor, just want to ask the both of you, a key critique from the DUP at the time, they came out, politician after politician after politician came out and said, the media are out to get Arlene Foster out of the job, out of the office of First Minister. There's an anti-DUP agenda. Sam, you work for a major unionist newspaper. Yeah. What do you think about it? I mean, it was senior. It wasn't just kind of the crazies in the DUP. It was people like Simon Hamilton who were positing this as well, that there was a media agenda against Arlene Foster.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's fairly familiar territory for any political party when it's under pressure to shoot the messenger. And, I mean, sometimes obviously it's right to shoot the messenger if we get something wrong, but it's often very convenient to have a go at us. I mean, I can only speak for myself. I can't speak for what motivated anybody else to write about this. And I think sometimes people look at the media as a monolith. It's not. We are all individuals. We're individual media organisations of different values, different things they're interested in, different readerships, different editorial policies, all the rest of it. And from our point of view, it was very simple. It was a squander of public money. It was an outrage. And we were going to investigate it. And I think that one of the very significant things that drove us to really, and drove my editor to support me in this, which the DUP were very slow to realise, and Sinn Féin were very slow to realise as well, was the level of public anger about this. We could see it because in our web figures you get an instant snapshot of what people are reading, and it was clear that this was just going off the charts. You see paper sales week on week, and Stephen Nolan could see it because he could see the calls coming into the building, and he kept at it. And there was a period of several weeks where the DUP had this narrative that it was a media construct, that we were out of touch, that actually this was nothing like what it was being presented to be. I think that actually they ultimately came to realise that was nonsense, and obviously the election was part of that. But I think that fundamentally for us it was a very straightforward story. And it has to be said that my editor Alistair Bush deserves a lot of credit, because he faced down what was a threat from somebody who worked in Arlene Foster's office, a very lowly person but still very public and endorsed by two MLAs to boycott the newsletter because we were exposing aspects of what she did know about it personally, at a point when she was claiming she really knew very little and it was all the fault of the civil servants, as Alison was saying, and he really backed up what we were doing. And I think a weaker editor would have looked at that and taken fright. So I think that sometimes people who are not in public, who are not seen, actually deserve a lot of credit for some of these decisions.
And you mentioned, obviously, an important thing, and this is, of course, Sinn Féin's response to the... Because Sinn Féin, in December, when we watched the Arlene, I think we saw Carol Ní Chulainn try to do some deft manoeuvrings in the Assembly, trying to look like they were opposed to her, but also trying to keep the show on the road. What about Sinn Féin's role in it as well?
Sinn Féin was, I think, at its most indecisive in the 10 years that I've been covering politics, that I've ever seen them. And neither the DUP nor Sinn Féin are generally given to indecision. They are centrally run parties. They have very very disciplined, generally, followers. Sinn Féin was all over the place in this, and I think that actually when Sinn Féin ultimately brought down the Assembly, when Martin McGuinness famously walked out that day, gave his interview, I think that there has been a narrative since then that I suppose Sinn Féin did the right thing and they put it up to the DUP and they were holding them to account. Actually, that's nonsense. It may be right from that point, and it may be right. I'm just saying it may be right. But up until that point, they were bending over backwards at various points to try to get the DUP off the hook. Let's not forget that while we now look back at that executive and think it was dysfunctional, Arlene couldn't get on with Martin, all the rest of it, not so. This was a very united executive. They had appointed David Gordon as their joint spokesman to convey a joint message. They had actually secretly changed the law by royal prerogative in order to appoint David. And this was a very united, single-minded executive, which didn't want to be blown off course by this. And in certainly in the first couple of weeks in particular, and there was a period where we were being cheered by Sinn Féin supporters at various points for exposing aspects of what Arlene Foster had done. And when we started to say, well, hang on a minute, Sinn Féin are all over the place here, Declan Kearney went on the Nolan Show and described me as a juvenile journalist for daring to question this. And then, of course, a few days later, did another U-turn, and they said, we will have a public inquiry. So I think that belatedly Sinn Féin did the right thing in setting up a public inquiry. What they wanted was a behind-closed-doors inquiry, which would have been much more expedient in terms of getting over it quicker. It would have been faster, and I mean, that is an argument in its favour. It would have been cheaper, but would it have got to the truth? I think the concern from a lot of people would have been that things would have been covered up, the civil service would have been able to get off the hook, the DUP potentially, if it suited Sinn Féin, could also have got off the hook. So I think that Sinn Féin don't come out of this with a great degree of credit, certainly up to that point.
There goes that base you had on the Falls Road.
It was like my favourite tweet throughout the whole thing was that, you know, the newsletter had sold out somewhere in the New Lodge. I don't sell the newsletter in the New Lodge. That's why it was sold out. People were saying, I can't get a newsletter anywhere in the Falls Road. I can't need it even get in the first place.
It was behind the counter. Back to the question. So DUP bias, that was the story's put out, and then Sinn Féin's
just
role.
I mean, that is just what we hear every week. And I have had politicians from every single party telling me that I'm biased against them and that I'm plotting against them, that I have. And trust me, you know, I'm not plotting against anyone. I'm trying to get my day's work in or my wages. Like, I mean, I'm certainly not constructing an elaborate plot to lose anyone their job. But the fact of it was, as Sam said, right up until December, and we were all working right up until Christmas Eve, and Sinn Féin wouldn't say that Arlene should go. They did say that she should step aside. And we often wonder if she had have stepped aside for that couple of weeks and come back in January and that had a day down, what would have happened? Would the Assembly still at this point been functioning? I think it would have collapsed anyway. It was on its way to collapse no matter what. I think what happened then, as we know, it was the withdrawal of the Gaeltacht fund of the £50,000, and people were completely and utterly outraged. You know, here we had this scandal of mammoth proportions, you know, £450 million being wasted, being literally burnt. And at the same time too, you know, the pettiness of removing, you know, £50,000 from school children, I think, took people over the edge. And at that point in time, Sinn Féin could only answer to their electorate, and they had to at that point bring it down. Had that not happened, had Arlene Foster stepped aside, we could have been in a different place now. That's all woulda, coulda, shoulda. You know, I don't think that there's, when we go back and look at that, she had no intentions of ever stepping aside, and after the last election, I think she's probably pretty glad she didn't. But yeah, we pushed and pushed for Sinn Féin to say something about it coming up till December. And I think at that point in time, they'd taken the decision to step back and see what was going to happen with it. And most scandals, if you take any political scandal and you take the Christmas break and people go off on their Christmas holidays and have a couple of weeks and go off, most scandals would have died at that point, and this one just didn't. This was the scandal that wouldn't go away. You know, it really wouldn't. Probably because it was freezing and people were like, how much is my oil costing and all them farmers are getting free heat? And I think that's probably one of the reasons why. And the public anger retained, and then something had to be done. And as I say, the whole nonsense with the Gaeltacht fund, it was taken away, it was given back again. And there was complete and utter disrespect. I mean, here you had, you know, the DUP, who were a party under pressure, who was showing absolutely, you know, no humility at all, you know, no apologies, and instead, you know, we're still acting like, you know, the lords of the manor, and we'll put manners on these people. And I think that is what pushed Martin McGuinness and Seamus. I can't answer for Sinn Féin, but I think that's what pushed them over the edge. I think they could have, if they could have read out the RHI scandal, got the other end, they probably would have, and just went for an inquiry that would have took place. And like all inquiries and everything, nothing ever happens. You know, nobody ever gets sacked. They'll be surprised if anyone does at the end of this one as well.
Okay, I'm going to throw it open to the floor here for some questions. The gentleman at the front.
Can I ask you a question? Based upon what you uncovered, and based upon past patterns, how would you characterise the DUP's political philosophy and their political approach to delivering that philosophy?
Okay, so questions about DUP political philosophy and their approach to delivering it.
You know, it changes from leader to leader, and you can see that. You know, the DUP under Ian Paisley was a very different DUP than the DUP under Peter Robinson, which was a very different DUP than the DUP under Arlene Foster. You know, whoever the leader is of any party puts their stamp on it. I think that what we had seen was the DUP under Ian Paisley, we know what it was. You know, it was a never an inch, you know, they'll get nothing, and then that softened. And then I think that we had a period where we could see we had 10 years of function and devolution. And we got to the point where it actually looked like this might work. And then I think that there was a difference in when the DUP was actually trying to take votes, ironically not from Sinn Féin or anyone else, but from the Ulster Unionist Party. And we could see then a toughening of the stance, and it was going back to, you know, the days of old. It was an uncompromising DUP, a DUP who won't give an inch, and a DUP who was showing absolutely no respect at that point to the nationalist population. And I think that that was a sort of philosophy that was probably outdated by about 20 or 30 years, but one in terms of their electorate. And I don't know if any of you watched the sort of BBC Three documentary last night where, you know, this young English journalist came over and interviewed unionists around a bonfire who said, the DUP don't do anything for us, but we just vote for them anyway because if we don't, Sinn Féin will get in. You know, and I think that that was basically where where we are now at the minute. The DUP now, the philosophy is, if we're in trouble, start shouting at the unions under threat. That's basically it, and it's worked for them.
Okay. Sam?
Tell me if this doesn't answer your question properly, because I may have misunderstood it. I think the DUP are essentially a populist party. They are not motivated particularly by economics, which is unusual in most democratic systems. They have a very significant religious motivation within their membership, but that's not in any that's in decline, and it's not in any way necessarily representative of the entire party anymore. And I think that they are a party which these days see themselves as the party of government in Northern Ireland, the old Ulster Unionist Party in that regard, if not in other regards. And they see, I suppose, the success of Sinn Féin in terms of being very centralised, being very disciplined, and they try to mimic that, I think, in various ways. It's really run by a kitchen cabinet and a handful of spads, and that's one of the things which came out of this, was really a public interest in the role of people who hitherto had been completely unknown to the public. I mean, we know them because we deal with them, but most people wouldn't recognise their names. These are the most powerful people in Northern Ireland, in many cases more powerful than most of the MLAs. So it's run along a very hierarchical structure, but in terms of ideology, it's pretty fluid and it's pretty open to what the public want at any particular time.
And there's a lot of stability with the DUP spads. Like, so the spads under Ian Paisley as First Minister are still still with Arlene today.
Go ahead, sir. Some people might say that the DUP originally was quite parochial, but all those things you mentioned, Naaman, Red Sky, RHI, would suggest to me, and I'd like you to comment upon this, would suggest to me that their approach is somewhat different to other political parties and implies a certain lack of restraint. I get the impression, and I could be wrong, I get the impression that they feel they can get away with almost anything.
But they could. I mean, that's the point. They could. I mean, if you look back and you take all those scandals and you take, I mean, every one of those scandals, if that had happened anywhere else, would have finished off people and would have resulted in people losing their jobs and losing their positions, and they didn't. You know, they did. That is politics in the north of Ireland, you know.
I'm not going to say they're abnormal, but wouldn't normal political parties know the limits of what they should do? They don't seem
I don't find that really in most political parties. It's the idea of self-preservation at all costs, you know, and that usually comes through. And while what you'll see is if someone, basically, if they totally mess up, the party will still fall behind them. But a year from now, you know, they'll get sick or something, or their granny won't be well, and they'll have to go somewhere to look after them, and they won't come back again. But I mean, nobody ever gets the sack, because that's public suicide, you know, for that political party. So they just sort of move these people to side. One thing that Sam mentioned there was the SPADs, and we know from the Jonathan Bell interview with Nolan, I don't know, do you know what I mean? It was bunkers. But from that, and the praying and it, that the SPADs, he claimed, had a massive role. And we do know that those SPADs, and some of the SPADs that were in place and that were mentioned in that programme, are people who would have been, who I met in my first years, you know, as a journalist 18 years ago. And I remember meeting one in an election count and asking him, could I speak to Peter Robinson?